Well, hi again, everyone. I'm 1010 Wins Sports Director Mark Renee. This is On the Mark, where we take a look at the stories behind the stories in the world of sports. Today, we are talking about the sport of bowling, specifically women's bowling, and even more specifically, Fairleigh Dickinson University's women's bowling team, which is heading to the NCAA tournament in Kansas City as the Northeast Conference tournament champions. The Knights will face Sam Houston State in the opening round of the NCAAs on Wednesday. Their record 35-3 so far in 2021. And joining me in part one of our look at the Knights is Jenna Henderson. She is a senior from Washington Borough in New Jersey in Warren County, not to be confused with the Washington Township in Bergen County. She's one of four seniors on the Fairleigh Dickinson roster. And we say good morning and welcome, Jenna. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So how exciting is this to be heading to the NCAA tournament in just a couple of days?
This is so exciting. You know, we had a short season, but our hard work is really paying off, and we're so excited to be going to the national championships.
Now, how cool is it? You've gotten attention from Governor Murphy. I saw a tweet from Senator Booker. What's it been like?
It's been really cool. You know, nobody really knows about bowling, or, you know, we don't get a lot of press that other teams might, but, you know, it's been nice to kind of make a name for ourselves out there.
Okay, now I don't want to give them a free commercial, but where is your home, in air quotes, court, your home alley?
We bowl at a couple different centers around the area. We've been at Parkway Lanes. We've been at Bowler City. We were at Lodi for a little while.
So you bounced around the area, Elmwood Park and Hackensack, right? So you're pretty much Bergen County based, just like the campus in Teaneck. I have to ask, because obviously activities and sports have been severely impacted by the pandemic and the coronavirus for the, you know, beyond a year now. And I am, to be perfectly frank, one of those who do consider bowling a sport, even if a lot of other people call it something else, like an activity, but I think it's a sport. How has the sport of bowling in general, Jenna, been impacted by COVID? Because it seems you can, for the most part, maintain a social distance and you use your own ball. But I'm just curious to know, how difficult is it to deal with, you know, sanitizing and things like that while you're trying to compete?
I mean, luckily for us, like you said, we do have our own stuff. So, you know, what we have, we touch, we use, and we don't have to worry about it getting like contaminated or anything. It's just like, you know, bowling alleys seem cleaner now almost because they have to be cleaned so much because of, you know, public using the shoes, the balls, tables and chairs, like everything gets cleaned more. So if anything, it kind of helped promote cleanliness in the bowling world. I mean, it was always clean. But I mean, for us, you know, the only thing that really changed is that we wear our masks all the time when we're bowling. You know, before we didn't have to wear masks, but, you know, we make it work.
Now, you're a senior at Fairleigh. You have been bowling. I know you're pretty accomplished, or you were pretty accomplished back in your high school days at Warren Hills. When did you take up bowling? And please tell us why you took up bowling.
I started bowling when I was right around six. Just started in like a little bumper league. My parents got me into it. I come from a type of bowling family. You know, my parents bowled, my grandparents on both sides bowled, and especially like on my mom's side, my grandpa on that side was really like, hey, make sure you get her into bowling. And, you know, here I am.
So you must love it. You've been at it since you're 6 years old. So it's the better part of 15 years, right?
Yeah. I'm 22 now. So it's been
a good chunk
of my life. Yeah.
All right. So I have to ask, because my high score is 230. I'm going to guess yours is much higher than that.
299.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I'm compelled to ask you, where was it? And what were the circumstances?
I've had three.
Wait, you've had more than one $2.99?
Yes.
Oof.
I had two like a week apart at one point, a couple years ago when I was still bowling the Saturday league. Like I did it at my home house, Oakwood Lanes in Washington. I did it in the Saturday morning league. And then the next Saturday there was a tournament at the same place. And I shot $2.99 like both days. But I just couldn't get the last pin to fall, man.
Same lane. Well, I wanted to get back to that, but was it on the same lane? I know it was in the same house.
It was not on the same lane.
Okay. No. Cause that would be really weird. So I hate to bring this up, but you have 11 strikes. What's going through your head as you approach the line for that 12th?
I mean, I just want to throw a good shot because I know, like, I'm aware of what's happening. And, like, everybody around you kind of stops bowling because they're like, ooh, let's see. Can she do it? And, like, I just like to keep going. Like, you know, I want the world to keep moving. I don't want to, like, dwell on, like, oh, my gosh, this could happen right now. But, I mean, I just want to get up there and, you know, throw the good shot. If it carries, it carries. If it doesn't, it doesn't. I know I've been nervous on that last shot. You know, feeling like, oh, my gosh, I could do this right now. And then, okay, yeah. Like, I'm still just happy to get the 11 in a row because sometimes the strikes don't come easy.
Right. Okay, so obviously, if you got 9 pins on that last shot, you were right there. What goes through your head as the ball is rolling and heading toward the head pin and you see the last one doesn't go down? And it's happened to you more than once. I just can't even imagine the crushing feeling that I would have if that were me.
Yeah. I mean, the first time I just know I was really nervous and I almost left a split and then like a pin fell down. Like it wasn't the best shot. So like, it was weird. And I was just like hoping to get, you know, pins. I mean, like, so I was just that nervous. I was like, oh my gosh, I got to just throw the shot. Like this was like maybe 5 years ago. And then when I went the back-to-back weeks, I was like, oh, you know, good shots. And then it just didn't carry. So, you know, it's like, oh, carry, carry. No. But, I mean.
Wow.
You do what you can.
Wow. And the fact that you were able to do it twice in, you know, a span of 8 days is remarkable. What's your average, if you don't mind me asking?
We do averages a little differently in college because we have, like, frame averages for Baker because that's when 5 people will share one game. So like you just get 2 frames a game. So we kind of do frame average for that. And then we also have the traditional games as part of our matches. So I'm not sure exactly where I'm at right now.
Okay. You beat me to my next question because I had on the list the difference between traditional matches, these Baker match play matches. And then I know you've had these mega matches too. So please clue me and the rest of our audience in, if you don't mind.
Yes. So the traditional match is just like a normal bowling game. You know, 5 people from the team all bowl one game, like each. So we have, you know, the 5 lines going across. For the Baker, 5 people from the team will share one game. So everyone gets like 2 frames. So like the person that goes first gets the 6th frame and so on. And then the mega match is actually a combination of both formats. So it starts with a traditional match, then it goes into a Baker 5 game total pinfall. And then if needed, then it goes into a Baker best of 7.
Oh, wow.
So those matches can go to be like 4 hours long.
That's pretty involved. Now, how does the Baker work? Do you take 2 frames at a time or can you separate it and maybe do 1 frame at a time for 5 people and then cycle through again? How does it work?
Yeah, we do a rotation. So the person that goes first goes in the 6th frame. The second goes the 7th and so on through there.
So it's not like a traditional relay, if you will, where somebody would do the first 2 and then the next would do 3 and 4. And then there'd be the anchor, such as it is, would be 9 and 10. It doesn't work that way.
No. So this one, the anchor has the 5 and the 10.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Interesting. And where do you fall in terms of the rotation ordinarily for Fairleigh Dickinson during a Baker match?
For most of this season, I was in the anchor spot.
Okay. Okay. So that would lead us to potentially believe you are the quote unquote star on this team. Is that an accurate assessment?
I mean, I honestly think, like, we're all stars because we all put in, like, the hard work. And on days where I might not be doing as well, somebody else steps up or multiple people step up. So, I mean, we all just have each other's back.
Okay. I appreciate that. That was a very what's the word I'm looking for? That was a very non-ego answer. Good team player.
Yeah. I have been having, you know, one of the best seasons of my career so far, but, you know, I couldn't do it without my team behind me. So, you
know. Yeah, it's hard to put up 1,500 by yourself.
Exactly.
Do you have any idea, by the way, what is the record in a traditional match? What's the record score?
For our team, Amy Sherman had a 299 during the conference tournament, actually.
This year?
Yes, this year. I know in the past there have been 300s, but I'm not sure how recent that was.
But in terms of a team play concept where you have five in a traditional match, there's never been a 1,500, right?
No.
That would be crazy.
That would be awesome. I mean, we have shot like 1,200.
Which is still pretty darn good.
Which is, yeah, that was, you know, those are good matches. Yeah.
And I'm not going to do the math. I think that's 240, right? If I'm doing the math correctly in my head, I think that's a 240 average for five.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That is pretty good. I'm still stuck on your 299s, and I'm agonizing with you and visualizing that last shot, and they're not falling. I don't know how you – I know I would be curled up under the table and not want to leave. when you guys get out to Kansas City and get ready to roll on Wednesday, and I apologize for that horrible pun.
Okay.
What do you expect the team's attitude, the team's excitement level to be like?
Oh, we are just so excited because this is the time to just prove ourselves. Because, you know, we didn't get a full season like we normally do. And we just want to go out there, do the best we can and put it all out there because it's all we got left for this season.
Now, it should be noted that Fairleigh Dickinson does have two NCAA championship banners hanging from the rafters of the Rothman Center, having won in 2006 and again in 2010, runners-up in 2012. And I thought it was interesting looking back at the history of the women's NCAA bowling tournament, Jenna, that the tournament started, I guess, in 2004. And since then, it seems like only a handful of schools have ever won. Nebraska's got five of them. Maryland Eastern Shore, which is a place I'm very familiar with down there in Princess Anne, has three championships. And then tied for third are Fairleigh Dickinson, Stephen F. Austin, and Vanderbilt. And then you've got McKendree, which I've told you before, I've never heard of until I saw them on a replay on CBS Sports Network of a tournament final match from a couple of years ago. So they've got one. And then Sam Houston State, the school you're going to face on Wednesday, has one as well. What do you think it is that makes the title count so tight, if you will?
I mean, honestly, like, the matches are so intense, and it's just, you know, the strongest teams come out on top, because you could be having a great day, but if somebody's having a better day, it just, it's crazy just how, like, quickly things could change, too, because sometimes you might hit a funky lane, and, like, you might be on a high note, and then you're like, and then you start scrambling, and then the other team, you know, takes an advantage over it, or, you know, you might get the advantage over the other team.
Jenna, would you know how many schools offhand have NCAA bowling teams that would be eligible to try and compete for the big dance, if you will?
I think it's somewhere in the 80s range.
Okay.
I think this is, I was going to say this is the D1, but it's not because McKendree isn't.
Right.
But it's, right. Yeah. And like, there's certain criteria that like qualify the teams as well that like the NCAA committee chooses from that they keep to themselves. of
course. Not to make any trouble, but yeah, I think you're right.
But I mean, like, obviously, you know, they get the final decision, but there are, you know, a lot of great teams in the NCAA all around the country.
Right. So tell me, and maybe this is a question better put to Coach Lopresti in part two of this podcast, but what makes Fairleigh Dickinson so special in terms of women's bowling? What makes you guys a powerhouse?
I personally think it's just the hard work that we all put in, because we all want to be here and, you know, we all want to win. So we put in the work at the workouts, at the practices to make ourselves better and to try to elevate our games. And like, just this year, we've had a lot more or a lot better communication. I feel like this team has just kind of clicked and like everybody wants to work with everybody. Like, and that just like is something that, you know, there might've been some lacking in the past. Not that that was a bad thing. We still did well, but this year, like, I feel like we just communicate a lot better. I mean, we started the first tournament of the year. Coach had to stay home because he was considered a close contact to someone. So we traveled with an administrator and, you know, we kind of all just worked together at the first tournament of the season.
Wow. I mean, which Coach makes to me
his input, but yeah.
Yeah. That makes to me the record that you guys have posted, 35-3, is maybe even more impressive. Given that, would you, if you don't mind, take me back a little more than a month, February 20th, and you got Coach his 1500th career win. And folks, that sounds like a lot, but what was the most impressive thing to me is that Mike Lopresti is the only coach in NCAA women's bowling history to rack up even 1,000 wins. And now he's gone 50% beyond that. So, Jenna, if you don't mind, what was the atmosphere like on that day where he got number 1,500?
That was at one of our NEC meets for the season. And I would say, honestly, this might sound bad, but I didn't even know until like we saw the recap article that night that like he hit 1,500. And I was like, what? That's so cool.
So no big celebration afterwards, huh?
I mean, of course, they wrote a nice little article about him. And at our selection show, Brad presented him with a nice pin, you know, to commemorate the occasion. But yeah, like nobody really knew, or nobody on our team really knew. Huh. I mean, I'm sure Coach did, but, you know, he doesn't like to brag. And he's, you know, a real humble guy about it.
So oh, like, extraordinarily oh, no, humble. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. He's like, no, it was you guys. You guys helped me get here, you know?
Yeah. Did you know before you came to Fairleigh Dickinson that New Jersey had hosted two NCAA tournaments?
I did. I actually went one of the first days during one of the tournaments that was hosted, one of the championships.
At Carolier? In New Brunswick, North Brunswick.
Yeah, I went to watch that day. I think I was still in the decision process of like what I was thinking, but you know, just I wanted to see some of the teams in action because, you know, it's a cool opportunity to see what your future could look like. So I definitely wanted to check it out.
Yeah. So what's the atmosphere? You'll have a little bit of familiarity when you get to Kansas City with how NCAA tournaments work. At least you had a spectator's perspective. What was it like watching? Because I've been at Carolier. I don't know if it's called Carolier anymore. I think it has a more 21st century name. Yeah, right. Yes. Bolero. It's got a more 21st century name. But back when I went there years and years and years and years and years ago, it was Carolier Lanes right there on Route 1 in North Brunswick. And they hosted PBA events over the years and WPBA and all kinds of New Jersey state events. and obviously the NCAA tournament. What is an NCAA tournament bowling atmosphere like?
I mean, from having the spectator's perspective in the past and then being just a part of it is completely different. I mean, it's cool to be a spectator and like cheer on the team, but then being a part of it and being like physically in, like involved with the team, just is such a great experience because you feel all the emotions, you can be a part of the action and contribute to your team's success. And it's intense, but it is such a great experience.
And what do you know about any sort of spectator restrictions that'll be in place in Kansas City?
As of right now, I don't think there are spectators allowed. I know like we have two people from the school that are coming with us that will be like our spectators, but this season there have been no spectators. It's been a live stream out to our parents that are at home. You know, we miss having our crowd there because FDU always shows up. But, you know, we're happy that they show up just as much on the live stream.
Yeah, so you're talking about, you know, the energy and the atmosphere of, you know, not just a regular tournament, but, you know, the NCAA tournament. So how strange will it be, or will it be any different than what you'd have experienced already this season? But how strange is it to have a bowling tournament that is almost like being at a golf tournament in terms of, you know, what goes on during play, that there's just no reaction from the crowd, whether you do something good or bad?
Yeah, I mean, we make the reaction ourselves then to kind of fill the gap in, you know, a more toned down way, not as excited as the crowd, because we don't want to, you know, get too into it or overexcited and then have that be detrimental to us. But, you know, you still have like the environment of, you know, other matches are just as loud, so there is some like background noise, so it's not just completely quiet. But I mean, we definitely miss having our spectators there to, you know, pump us up and be present for us when, you know, things might not go as well. But
sure,
you know, sure, we're good at keeping the energy up ourselves, or reminding ourselves if we notice things are getting low, we're like, hey, let's energy up, let's go.
Jenna, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, and I should have probably asked at the outset, do you consider yourself, are you a power player or more finesse? Because we've seen varying styles over those of us who've bowled at any, you know, to any degree. And, you know, my career ended in a youth league probably too long ago. I'm not going to mention how many years, but, you know, my peak was the 230. But, you know, there are some of us who are power rollers. There are some of us who, you know, barely get the ball, you know, up the lane very slowly, but have good placement. And obviously then there are some of us who are somewhere in the middle. What do you consider your own style? Is it more power or finesse?
I feel like I'm toward the middle, but a little bit more power, because I, you know, my ball motion down the lane is a lot just straighter, and then it hooks in. Like, it's not like I'm trying to make like angles like a finesse player.
Right.
So I'd say more on the power side, but I can, if I need to, open it up to have a little bit more finesse.
And you're a lefty, so how different do you find the conditions? Because obviously most bowlers, like the majority of people in the world, are right-handed. Do they have to take any special precautions or special measures to make sure that each lane is conditioned equally for lefties and righties?
I mean, the way they set the patterns up kind of does that for us. So pretty much all of the patterns are symmetrical. So they're the same, like on both sides. So it's just, you know, the right side breaks down quicker because there's more righties. So the one thing I've noticed is I really, like, once I have a line, I don't really move as much as the right-handers might. Like, I might make little moves just throughout the day to, you know, keep my line where relatively where I'm at, but you know, the righties might change zones. They might need to increase or decrease the angles and to try to, you know, best play the pattern for themselves.
And who was your favorite bowler growing up?
Growing up, it was probably Parker Bone because he was left-handed. So I was like, oh, that's so cool.
And a Jersey guy.
And he's a Jersey guy. And now, like, I've gotten to know him over the years, and he's just a great guy overall.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's you know, the bowling community is it's so vast because there are so many people who participate. But it really is. It's also very close knit. I've always got a kick out of that. And they're really good golfers, too. I don't know if you know about this, but most of those pro bowlers also really, really good on the golf course.
Yeah. No, my dad, if summertime, if he's not bowling on the weekends, he's out on the golf course.
See?
He loves it. He tried to get me into it, but my patience goes as far as mini golf, and that's about it.
Well, listen, good luck in Kansas City, opening round against Sam Houston State on Wednesday. And we look forward to following your exploits on the live stream. And I'll certainly be keeping the audience updated on how you guys are doing out there in the NCAA tournament.
Thank you so much.
That's Jenna Henderson. And next, we will welcome in her head coach, Mike Lopresti. And coach, with the UConn women having been knocked out of the basketball tournament, I don't think we have any other area contenders for an NCAA title in the winter sports. So to borrow the line from Star Wars, you're our last hope, Obi-Wan.
Hey, that's a, you know, it's a great opportunity for us, and it's a great feeling just to, you know, represent our region and our area and our states and in the metropolitan New York area. Very proud to be representing this group. And you know, it's our program over the history, we're used to being like the last team alive, you know, going at it. We've been lucky to had a couple of positive results, but when we get there, you know, it's our goal is just to treat it as if it's just like a normal match or a normal tournament, because we really don't know what we're going to come across. The only teams we've played were basically the NEC teams, the local teams. We haven't faced the teams in the central region and the Midwest at all this year. So, you know, we don't know how we match up. But on the flip side, they don't know anything about us either. So it should be, you know, a great tournament.
Now, you're being modest when you say you've had positive results. You're a two-time NCAA champion, 2006 and 2010. You were also the runner-up in 2012. And, you know, I talked to Jenna about your accomplishments, as you are the only coach in the history of the program going back almost 20 years now. But you are also the only bowling coach in NCAA history with not only over 1,000 wins, but back on February 20th, you hit number 1,500, and your team didn't even know about it because you don't talk about it. So congratulations. And what was it like to hit that milestone, number 1,500?
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, this is a team sport, and, you know, the focus is team first, and the, you know, personal accomplishments, you know, always take a back burner, a back seat. But, you know, for me, it's a nice feeling, you know, but in reality, anything, you have an accumulation record, it just means you've been around a long time, you know, but it's the positive, the 1500 wins. It's because we've had a lot of great families who allowed their student athletes to come in our program and believe in what we were trying to accomplish and believe in the, you know, the message and the training and the philosophies of what we put forth. And, you know, when you have, you know, a lot of really good kids in the program over the years, you accumulate a lot of wins, you know, and, you know, it's, you know, there's a lot of great programs too out there. You know, we've just been fortunate. We came across our program, just to go back a little bit in history here, our program was the 40th program that signed up for NCAA bowling way back when in 2002. And that's what made it an official championship sport. So the NCAA needed 40 programs to have a national championship. So we were the team that put us over the top. And then it was pretty awesome that, you know, in our fourth season, we won our first championship, and basically with the first recruiting class, the first three student athletes that we recruited were starting in that national championship match. And, you know, and we're on the lanes when we did win it. So, I mean, that alone right there is just a phenomenal experience and a phenomenal story. And over the years, though, again, it's just constant, like, roll with the punches, constantly evolving, making adjustments throughout the years. And, of course, the support of the school, the support of the institution to our program, where they didn't have to invest in us like they did, and they didn't have to give us the five full scholarships early on, which helped us recruit some, you know, top-notch talent, you know. And then, you know, plus the institution, again, has really supported us and treated us as equals. You know, bowling overall, you know, has a knock, you know, we lack a little respect. A lot of people don't look at us as an athletic sport. So at FDU, though, bowling always mattered, and they always treated us as student athletes. So, you know, I hate this label that they give the bowlers. They're called unconventional athletes. And to me, it's such a negative stereotype, because these players, particularly this team as well, they really work just as hard as any of the student athletes, any other sport. And it's a repetitive style skill sport. So no different than golf, no different than track, no different even than baseball and softball, you know. So, you know, and that's how we train them in that respect. So we always have to, like, earn our respect. And then the success always, you know, gives it to us.
Well, I have to tell you, as I explained to Jenna in our previous conversation, I am 100% in your corner in terms of sport versus activity. Anything that, you know, you can go from 200 plus, or, you know, perfect game 300 one day, back to a 150 the next, that takes skill and the hand eye coordination. I think it absolutely is a sport, and should be in the minds of everyone qualified as that. Hey, before we start to talk about the challenges of coaching a team in the COVID era, I want to wrap up conversation about the tournament that you're heading out to play first Sam Houston State in the opening round on Wednesday in Kansas City. You talked about the 40 programs back in 2002 that now made this an official NCAA sport. But if you look at the list of the championships since the first tournament in 2004, mentioned you guys have won two, same as Vanderbilt and Stephen F. Austin, Maryland Eastern Shore, which, you know, does not have a sports championship pedigree by any stretch, has three of them. Nebraska has won five, and there are only two other schools, Sam Houston State, who you'll face on Wednesday, and McKendree with one apiece. So that's seven schools that have ever won championships. What makes you seven schools so much better than everybody else?
Well, it's all different, you know. So my perspective was, I was going to treat it as an athletic team from the beginning. So I always went out and looked for bowlers who played other sports. Okay, so I was going to train them like athletes. And I always felt that an athlete, a student athlete who bowled, gave us an edge over somebody who just bowled. Okay, and then we all different types of skills are earned and trusted through the athletic mindset, you know. So in bowling nationwide, many of the high school players are only coached by their parents, or they're coached on by, like, a Saturday morning volunteer. When you play other sports, you're being coached by a stranger, you know, somebody who is, you know, a professional. And that, so I felt like if I wanted to attract those type of student athletes to come to our program, so then, you know, I wouldn't be too overly intimidating, or they would buy into what I was trying to teach them and trying to work and improve and evolve them into the, you know, a national level player. So that was our perspective, you know. And then you have other programs like Nebraska, you know, who they, you know, they're a Big Ten school now, you know. Back then they weren't in the beginning, but now they are. And, you know, that school totally bought it. And they have lanes on campus, two full-time coaches. So, you know, so they are looking in their perspective is they're teaching their kids more like a bowling program, bowling skill oriented program, but they have the facilities and the funding to do it. That goes the same with like Maryland Eastern Shore, who same type of thing. They were just recruiting like international players, the top players from all over the world to come in, and they had a lot of success doing that. You know, and then like Vanderbilt, same thing, an SEC school. So big investment, lanes on campus, two full-time coaches. You know, they so that's why there's success there. In the two Texas schools like SFA and Sam Houston, who we play, you know, in the first round, they're like state schools there. So they have like low tuition, but Division I, big investment. So they have, again, like Sam Houston has lanes on campus, SFA doesn't, but they, you know, their bowling center is very cooperative with them, but they have full-time coaches. So that's kind of like what it is. It's FDU and teams in the Northeast, where I'm a part-time coach, and, you know, and this year I didn't even have assistant coach, you know, because of COVID,
right,
and because of furloughs, I'm going at it by myself. So, you know, and that's why we're kind of unique, but basically what it comes down to is experience, you know, and being able to attract, you know, the student athletes that come, and then just training them correctly. So everybody has different philosophies, but the bottom line, when it comes down to, you know, my first collegiate bowling team that I ever coached dates all the way back to the 1980s when I was a coach for William Patterson club teams way back then, but both men and women. Okay. So I brought that to the table when FDU, we started the program at FDU. So I had a lot of experience and competed against all like Bill Stroud from Nebraska and competed against all the best coaches and best programs all along. So for me, I have a lot of, you know, background experience and just, again, trying to persuade the families of these student athletes to buy into what I was trying to tell them. You know, that first team, I told them, I said, look, we're going to win championships here. And I don't know what all the coaches are telling you when they're recruiting you, but I'm going to tell you, I know, you know, we're going to win championships here because I've done it. You know, I won championships at William Patterson. So therefore, that gave me a little bit of an edge. But the limitation comes because we're all still in it, right? So I'm doing this for almost 20 years at the NCAA level, but I'm still in it. So it's not like, you know, it's a kind of a sport where I don't have to map out like defenses, you know, and then like football or basketball, you know, or if I don't recruit the top pitchers in the area, we're going to struggle. So in this game, you know, we can bring in, even middle level, high school skill level players and coach them up in a very rapid way. And then, you know, hopefully we'll get them to the national level like we did this year and, you know, and knock heads with all the big schools, the SECs and the Big Tens. I mean, and that's really the story of us. And the other schools are following the same model that we put forth. So, again, strength and conditioning. So we were one of the first programs that incorporated strength and conditioning way back in like 2004, 2005, where we got involved with it with a strength coach. And then, you know, the other schools saw what we were doing and saw how our endurance was better and how our balance was better, how our core strength was better than the other programs. They, of course, they bought in, you know, and they did the same thing that we were doing. So it's kind of like a combination of a lot of things. In the long run, you're going to see more programs start winning titles or advance to the NCAA tournament. Like, we finally got the field expanded. So, you know, I was lucky to be on the committee, the national committee, when we added automatic qualifiers.
Right.
But that wasn't until like 2015, 2016. You know, so before that, it was only Elite Eight. Only the top eight teams got it. So if the NCAA is only limiting eight teams to the national final, that's why there's only so few schools, you know, that have won. Now that it's expanded to 16, you're going to see more teams start winning. Hopefully we'll get number three this year, you know, and then everybody else is going to have to wait another year.
Yeah. Now, as for those 16 this year, four of them NEC schools, what does it mean to you as a coach in the conference to have three of your competitor schools going to the dance with you?
Oh, it's tremendous. The administration at the NEC is so proud and so excited. And, you know, we, again, we were on the ground floor. We were one of the programs on the ground floor, a charter team, when we started this in 2009. And it wasn't easy getting programs to buy in, schools in the NEC to buy in, but they did. And, you know, so now going out there with the four of us, you know, we got NEC has a great opportunity to bring home a big trophy. You know, the big trophies go to the Final Four, and of course, the biggest trophy goes to the champion. But I mean, like, the only thing I'm disappointed in is that teams are going to knock heads. I wish they put all four of us in the four different regions. Then that would have been great. Would have been like, you know, Big East back in the late 80s, right, you know, right. And men's hoops, when they had three of the four teams, you know, in the Final Four. So I mean, that's kind of like when, you know, we all along, I felt we were going to get four teams. I mean, our season this year was a little different, unconventional. We kind of only did, most teams only did conference competition. But you could see the level of play has improved, and the coaching is so much better than it's ever been. So, you know, getting four teams in the Final 16 is, you know, it's definitely something that we deserve.
Yeah. Now, talking about the experience, you have obviously had experience at the tournament, but if my math is correct, this is your first trip in 4 years, and I'm not sure if you have anybody on the squad now who would have been a freshman back then. So as far as the experience for your ladies when they take to the floor, the alley, on Wednesday in Kansas City, how do you expect them to feel? How will you be feeling? Will it be more a sense of relief that you're back in this or on this stage, or is it sort of old hat for you by now?
Well, we don't have anybody that's been in the NCAA tournament before on this group. You know, this was a group because the way it works now with so many programs in the Midwest to have like top notch coaches. I mean, McKendry, for instance, their Division II, they have the Team USA coaches as their coaches, so they have a big leg up and to attract those type of players into their program. But so for us, my plan basically once the AQs came about. Out, which we knew we can get an automatic bid just by winning the conference, we changed our plan. You know, we went after a different style of student athlete who bowls, where we were going to go mid-range, maybe kids in the top 100, that zone, maybe 50 to like 150 in that area, and then coach them up. And we knew it was going to take some time. So we've been grooming this group all along. Now, you know, don't get me wrong. Last year, we feel we would have made it. Unfortunately, because of COVID, the postseason got shut down.
Right.
We were one of the hottest teams in the country last year at the end of the year. And, you know, we were just steamrolling. When our last 10 matches and rolling into the NEC tournament, we were hot as fire. And we would have I think, done very, very well. And if it didn't win the conference, we would have gotten a large bid. But you know, hey, look, we can't, you know, it's water under the bridge, basically. But yes, since 2017. So the tactic we're going to take was we know they're going to have like, you know, a deer in the headlight syndrome when they first get there, you know, because they had never experienced before. We're going to recommend that they take everything like a sponge. We want them to enjoy the experience. But once we get on the lanes for the practice session, which is going to be Tuesday at 4:30, it's back to business, and we're just going to talk them down to the, you know, run-of-the-mill level of mentality. Right? This is just normal. We're bowling. The best thing you do in life is bowl, athletically, that is, and it's just normal. You know, you've thrown thousands of shots, and we're just going to continue it, you know. And then the level of competition, again, it's going to be stiff, but I don't think it's going to be any different than we faced all year long. You know, it's not a sport where there's defense. You know, there's different ways we can play a little defense about lane play and different things like that. But bottom line, I can't send somebody down in front of the pins and stop the ball, right? Like a basketball, right? I can't do any of that. You know, I can't set up a goal line stance, right? So they can't, you know, run it in. So what we have to do is, you know, just recognize like it's us, you know, it's us against the lanes and the pins. And then, you know, focus out what the other team is doing until, you know, when things matter, really. So that's kind of like how we're going to go about it. And that's really what we did in the NEC tournament this year. because we've made it to the NFC tournament every year with this group, not with positive results, where some years we were, you know, 0-2 in the barbecue, you know, and then a couple, then the last time we won the first two and then lost the next two. So, so we just wanted to go in just saying, hey, look, you know, it's, you know, we're number one seed. Let's just play the best we can. And then, you know, things worked out great. Look, this group though, because they've been through the war, trials and tribulations over the years, and developed and evolved and grown so much since their freshman year. Very mature group, very confident group, very driven group. They feel they want to prove to everybody how good we are. And so I think that's going to lead to a lot of success out there.
Well, I wish you the best of luck. I know you're heading out on Monday, and I want you to travel safely. Before I let you go, I just had two more questions.
Okay.
First, about coaching a team in the pandemic. Obviously, I have the experience with basketball and volleyball and soccer and baseball and softball, but not so much bowling. And obviously, as I was talking to Jenna, we talked about how it's a little bit perhaps easier to maintain the social distancing, although it's not usually part of the procedure, and you're using your own ball, your own shoes, so you don't really have to worry about contamination. But from a coaching standpoint, how difficult has all this been the last 13 months?
Well, it's just so many more steps, so many more responsibilities that we have now. And so my goal in the beginning, when we started to map out how we're going to train them, was let's try to make the unordinary ordinary. So make things more routine. So that was the beginning. So we were lucky that, like, other NEC schools didn't get this. We were lucky that even though we weren't competing in the fall, our institution allowed us to train and work out. And in the beginning, it was like different kind of groups, smaller groups, you know, different pods. And then eventually we were able to graduate to a full team effort, but spread out. And then eventually we were able to, you know, get a little closer so we could do some team activities. But that took like 6 weeks. And during that 6 weeks, what I really wanted to focus on was just getting them to a competitive level again. So sure, we did work on skills, and sure, we did work on strength and all those type of things that all athletic teams do. But the one thing that was taken away because of the COVID pandemic was, like many areas, the bowling centers were closed for a long period of time. So our kids, as great as we were in March last year, many of them didn't pick up a bowling ball until the summer. So they went a long time, and everything was basically shut down. Mm-hmm. They could, you know, couldn't bowl league, couldn't bowl tournaments. And so then we had them like do like little mini drills in their garage, in their basement, in their backyard. You know, just rolling balls, trying to do like little foul line skill drills. But of course, that's not the same as competing, right? This is a sport. So it's all about, you know, my goal is to make them the fierce, most highly competitive student athletes so we can, you know, win matches. So they were missing that. So that's what we did in the fall. We did the drills and the skills. We did the strength. But then I created all different types of competitions for them just to get them competitively ready. But then, of course, you know, Thanksgiving comes, we get shut down again, and the kids get sent back home, you know. So that was my big fear, is that, you know, what's going to happen during that break, you know. We had like a big long break. We weren't able to get started really until February, but once we got started, it was like a distraction in the beginning. The kids were just so happy to be with each other. So the first like half hour, the first couple of practices, I let them do it, just socializing, re-socializing.
Right.
Meeting up with their friends, talking, because everything's isolated. You know, the kids in the dorms, they're in their own room. All classes are remote. You know, it's like a detention center, you know. So the practices became more re-socialization. And then once, you know, it created a huge bond, like one of the most cohesive groups we've ever had in the history of the program. It's this group. And they really like each other, and they really root for each other, and they really push each other. And they're so knowledgeable, you know, about what they need to do. So, I mean, a lot of the times I just take two steps back and watch them do it, autopilot, you know. So I don't know if Jenna told you the story. Our first tournament this year, I couldn't go. I was right. Quarantined. I'm a full-time history teacher at Fort Lee High School. So one of my colleagues, unfortunately, was positive, and I had a close contact. So I had a quarantine for 14 days back then. Wow. So, and of course, it overran into our first tournament of the year, which was down in North Brunswick, Carolier Lanes. So the kids went down with an administrator. I was home. So I actually coached the team from home through the live stream.
Wow.
You know, just texting messages, right? So I was like the OC during a football game, you know, the guy in the booth, you know, with the earphones.
Exactly.
Right? And it was crazy. Look, I didn't do much. All I did was work like lineups and substitutions, you know. But what made it even difficult was there was like a 7-second delay. So now I had to be extremely proactive, like a frame ahead, trying to figure out what I had to do, you know, because we didn't figure out it was a 7-second delay to like the second match. Wow. How funny is that?
That's wild.
You know, but the kids did great. They went 9-1 that weekend without me there.
Uh-oh.
And that weekend was such a growth weekend for them because they really understood that they were good enough, that they were knowledgeable enough, that they can take care of business without the coach there with them. And then after that moment, after that weekend, you know, it's been lights out. You know, we're 35-3. I mean, it's unheard of.
Yeah. Now, see, it might be one of the good things to not having an assistant because you couldn't get Wally pipped. You know, Rangers fans, right. When David Quinn, you know, left, he was quarantined for the Rangers. They brought the guy in from Hartford, and they wound up winning 9-0 the first game he coached.
Right. So
they were joking that Quinn was going to be Wally Pipped, and the new guy would be Lou Gehrig. I want to put you on the spot if you don't mind, because we have so many bowlers in our audience. You're a premier bowling coach, obviously the accolades, we could go on all day. What can you tell anyone who's listening or interviewing you who has bowled a lot but not so well over the course of one's life? For example, and I'll throw a hypothetical at you, not me, career high 230, usually averages though around 150 if he's lucky or she. What can you say to anyone without actually seeing how they throw the ball, what they can do to improve their game? Is there anything at all?
Sure there is. Okay. So the bowling ball is heavy, right? So like our team, everybody on the team uses 15-pound balls. They go as high as 16. Okay. And some years we've had some kids using 14, but mostly it's 15. That's trying to eliminate deflection. But because the ball's heavy, it's not like a basketball. It's hollow, or a volleyball, or even a baseball. It's only 5 ounces, or a softball, right? 5.5 ounces. The thing is, you don't throw the ball. You got to swing it, and you got to roll it, okay? And that's the first thing. You got to learn how to swing it and roll it. And when you swing the ball, it has to be perpendicular to the foul line or parallel to the lane boards. Okay.
Right.
So how do you do that? Because you're swinging the ball and you're walking toward the foul line, you know, so that's going to take some practice, but also you have to teach yourself how to walk straight, you know, and then the ball is on one side. So now your body is off balance, right? You're used to having nothing on both sides, you know, so now you have the 15 extra pounds or whatever the weight of the ball is on one side of your body. So now you have to do different things to maintain balance. And that's where the core strength comes in. So the whole idea is, as you walk toward the foul line, you need to post at the line. You need to have a solid base, and you have to be like, your body has to be very still. Your head has to be still. You have to walk straight and you have to have a free swing. And when you get to the line, you have to maintain your balance. So if you ever watch like the best bowlers, that's why for a righty, that's why you see that left arm out to the side straight up, and they see their right leg sweep around, because that counterbalances the extra weight on the bowling side, on your bowling hand side.
Right.
Okay. So that's where I would start. I always start there. We always start with approach, is teaching them how to walk straight, teaching them how to swing freely, you know, and then end at the foul line, perfect balance. And try to keep your body quiet, keep your head quiet, you know, so now you can be consistent with how you roll the ball. You're not chucking it, you know, you have to roll the ball. Now, of course, as you improve, you got to get a ball that fits. Okay. So if you're like one of those people that your ball doesn't really fit well, you can't relax your hand. If you're squeezing the ball, now it's hard to have a free swing. So you have to get a ball that fits, and you know, the finger holes are constant, but, you know, weather, your hand's going to change shape. So that's why I use tape. Use tape in the holes to keep the holes snug. And if you relax your hand, the ball's going to always fall off your hand. So, but it takes some time, you know, it really does. Look, this year, our biggest accomplishment in our team, we had a player come to us this year as a walk-on, basically. We ended up giving her a little bit of a scholarship because she's just, you know, passionate about this sport, which so many people out there are. They just love this game.
And oh, yeah.
It just doesn't get the respect it deserves. But she comes, and she's a pharmacy student, very bright student, and FDU has this new pharmacy program. So we brought her in. She came. We added her to our program. She came in last year. She was at a high school program. She did bowl in the high school team. She averaged in the 160s. She is so improved, the most improved player on our team. And all we did was exactly what I just described. We just taught her how to walk straight. We taught her how to keep her body quiet. We taught her how to free swing. We got her new equipment, made all the balls fit. And then next thing you know, now she shoots games in the 200s.
Wow.
With consistency. So it can happen really rapidly, rather quickly.
Okay. I just need you one last thing. I know I said last thing before. You need to tell my mom throwing the ball halfway down the lane was not the way to teach her sons how to bowl.
No, it's not. You know, but it's because loft is necessary when the lanes are hooking, but right. Mostly you want to roll the ball. You don't want to
not a third of the way or halfway down.
No. Yeah. Ironically, though, I don't know if Jenna mentioned this to you. Her dad does that. He stands up real tall. He had some issues with his back, and he launches it and gets it out to the lane, like 10 feet on the lane. And he has over 5,300s.
Wow.
So maybe there's something to it.
Unbelievable. Hey, Coach, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. Good luck out in Kansas City. We'll be tracking your progress against Sam Houston State on Wednesday. And then obviously as you progress through the double elimination region there and hopefully bring home one of those big trophies. Okay.
I hope so, too. Thanks for the time. I really appreciate it.
That is Coach Mike Lopresti. Before him, Jenna Henderson. I'm Mark Arnay, and you're On the Mark.